Please keep in mind this podcast was recorded on March 10th and 11th, so there's a good chance there will have been changes to some of the facts and figures by the time you hear it. Coronavirus is here in the United States, and people would like to know what the government has done to prepare and what we can expect from federal agencies as the disease will likely spread further. Welcome to this deep dig edition of the Watchdog Report, where we focus on larger issues. We're going to hear from the people behind the work at GAO, their efforts and their experiences. You know, things we could dig deeper on. And this episode is all about pandemic preparedness and the nation's biodefense strategy. And here to talk with me are GAO experts Mary Dennegan McCauley, Chris Curry, and Tim Persons. Before we get to the work GAO has done in this area, and in light of the current coronavirus outbreak, Mary, what's the government been doing up to now?
Importantly, they passed a supplemental package, which will help us to get the appropriate funds for surveillance so we can continue to monitor how much it's spreading here in the United States. It's going to help with state and local public health officials to get up to speed as well. And diagnostic testing is incredibly important.
Chris?
I would agree. I think the government does plan for these types of things. There have been different agencies like Department of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services have developed specific pandemic planning, and they've done exercises. So certainly a lot of the things that they've learned and are spelled out in that and those documents are being executed right now. I think what's unique about this case is compared to what's happened in recent years, there hasn't been a large domestic outbreak like this in quite a while, really since like H1N1 in 2009. That definitely makes this particular outbreak different, I think, is leading to some of the scarier things that we're seeing and hearing about or worried about as compared to like Ebola a couple years ago or Zika, where most of those situations were offshore.
So Tim, you've worked on a recent report that was specifically on coronavirus, a spotlight. How prepared was the government to respond to this outbreak of coronavirus based on past GAO work?
I think that past lessons that we have from our work, of course, as Chris and Mary are pointing out, there's a preparedness element of that. Hindsight is 20/20, as they say, and so I think our past work looking at other pandemics in the past, the H1N1 and so on, the H3N2, the SARS, or these other outbreaks, not necessarily pandemics, but they have each time we have to face this, we essentially gain new insights into how or where we are lacking. And so all the preparedness dimensions of that, the need for advanced research and development, a upgrade into sort of an agile, pan-governmental operational tempo, right? Even just within the Department of Health and Human Services, you have all these incredible and important elements and functions going on there, whether it's research at the National Institutes of Health, that's under which a part of our vaccine development works under that domain. But then you also have to run through the regulatory process, because if you're going to start to imagine developing vaccine quickly, you still want to test it because you want your vaccine to be safe.
So what are some of the challenges the federal agencies face either within this government-wide approach or as individual agencies?
Coordination is easy to say and hard to do. I mean, there's legal authorities and functions and uniquenesses of all of them. And again, this is, I can speak just within the domain of the Department of Health and Human Services, and the coordination between itself is a challenge, much less if you start saying, well, let's involve, because so many of our service members are overseas, and that's a Department of Defense issue. All right, there's so many Homeland Security, the folks securing our borders, or they're doing screening at the airports and things like that. So that's a Department of Homeland Security function. And State Department, and in terms of international relations, there's all of this sort of this cross-cutting broad view, I think, is are part of the challenges. And then within each of those challenges, each one of those entities has their challenges in their way. If you're screening, let's say, at the border airport checkpoints, and you're trying to see, can you detect in a non-intrusive, non-invasive way that doesn't slow or practically shut down the transit system so that you can screen for potentially infected people, try and quarantine quarantine them, you know, implement safeguards and things like that.
So what can we expect to see next from the government?
I think the key right now is testing. You know, I mean, we have to get a handle on how many cases there are and how fast this is spreading. I don't think anybody knows that right now. We still don't have good numbers on the virulence and the mortality rate for this disease. There's a lot of guessing going on and a lot of projecting going on based on the cases that there are overseas. But I think even the information from overseas, we're not even sure if that's reliable now. So I think one of the biggest steps right now is just trying to figure out how bad this is. And that makes it extremely difficult to know what concrete actions to take. So like when you start talking about quarantining populations or closing schools or restricting domestic travel, it's very difficult to make those kind of decisions with incomplete information.
Well, then that begs the question and points to GAO's past work. Were government agencies prepared for this?
We're a lot better prepared now after the H5N1 back in 2005 time period. The federal government has taken an active role in preparing for a pandemic, being able to move forward with the telework and et cetera, things like that. So there's no question that we're in a better position now, and Health and Human Services takes the lead when it's a public health or medical response, and they have been working closely with FEMA and with the local and state and even with USDA, for example. If it's an infectious disease outbreak that also involves animals. So our past work has shown that that coordination has gone on and will continue to work. So we've laid the foundation for that.
And I would agree with that. I think the thing that's so unique about biological events, though, is unlike cyber attacks or natural disasters, they just don't happen every month or every year. So it's incredibly difficult to, you can exercise these things and develop plans, but it's just really difficult to know how to handle these things operationally if you don't have a real-world event very often, particularly one domestically where there's a big spread and it's not just a sort of a vague offshore threat.
That does lead to the fact that the exercises are absolutely key because you have to know who your partners are so that you're not trying to figure out how to do the response during the time of the emergency.
Tim, is there any insight about what makes this current outbreak such a difficult thing to test?
That's a great question because we want the diagnostics. That's a key issue right now that we're seeing. Having not only enough tests, but making sure that the tests we have are as accurate as they can be. One of the challenges in the activity of diagnostic medical testing is making sure we avoid what are called false positives, which means the test says that you have something when you really don't. And sometimes even worse in this kind of scenario is what's called the false negative, meaning it says you don't have it when you actually do. What makes this one so challenging at the moment is because it's so new, we haven't seen it before, you've got to do the entire development cycle of a diagnostic, and you want, again, to minimize false positives and minimize false negatives. And because you have to treat patients that come in, as is happening now, patients are going into clinics, and they're saying, look, I have flu-like symptoms, but do I have coronavirus, right? And you want the system to be able to reliably and in a very timely manner, not days later. You'd like to know right away, ideally, and you want it with high accuracy. I do think that though it's difficult, I think like we've just recently wrapped up some work on artificial intelligence for drug development, and really a vaccine is just a variant of a drug to develop. And so we're really talking about using advanced machine learning systems and AI to try and essentially de-risk the research and try and find those things that maybe we can find them faster and then put it into that development pipeline, work on the agility of that development pipeline, open up and share more among especially the federal biomedical research community that sometimes it shares with itself, but not necessarily with a lot of our very good academics and maybe some nonprofit research institutions or even partnerships with for-profit institutions, and leverage the massive and powerful innovation system and institution that we have here in the United States.
Were there any other issues that you have found in prior work that we know are out there that we can expect the government's going to have to contend with other than testing?
For over a decade, really starting after H1N1 in 2009, we started raising serious concerns about the U.S.'s ability to handle something like this for a number of reasons. First of all, it doesn't happen very often. It's hard to predict. It's a what we call like a no-notice event. It's not like a hurricane where you get a week's notice that something's coming. The other thing is it's spread out so much across the federal government and the state and local government and the private sector. And while there are some clear authorities, and Mary talked about it, like under a public health emergency, biodefense, I think there's over two dozen presidentially appointed officials at the federal level with some sort of responsibility for biodefense. So we've been concerned about our ability as a government to coordinate day-to-day activities and a response like this. So we actually just issued a report 2 weeks ago on the National Biodefense Strategy. It's the best effort we've seen so far over the decades to try to coordinate that. That should help. It's not a response strategy for something like what's happening with COVID-19, but it's the day-to-day foundation that you need to better prepare for something like this.
So it sounds like the government has a day-to-day strategy to better prepare for an outbreak like this. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about some elements of that strategy that should give you confidence. Don't panic.
CDC has put out basic information that just washing your hands. If you're not feeling good, stay home.
Interested in learning more from the U.S. Government Accountability Office? Be our friend and like us on Facebook. Our Facebook page has the latest information on our reports, blog posts, podcasts, videos, photos, interactive graphics, and much, much more. That's facebook.com/USGAO. That's facebook.com/USGAO.
We can have confidence that everyone who's involved, all of those dozens of agencies that look at biological events, are coordinating and working together to address the issue. Importantly, CDC has put out basic information that just washing your hands. If you're not feeling good, stay home. We recognize that that can be challenging for some people whose salary is an hour by hour and they may want to go, but that social distancing, these are basic things that people can do.
And I think just having a reasonable stockpile, I don't think you have to, you know, prep for any doomsday event here, but I think you need to have several days worth of various things. And I think shift the paradigm into what can I do in terms of working from home, education from home, caretaking at home. Those are the potential, or those are the things that I think that you're seeing what we can do to protect ourselves. Again, avoiding panic.
You mentioned not panicking. What's the good news here? What can we feel confident about?
Remember, about 80%, to the best of the science knowledge that's out there right now, about 80% of those infected either have no or mild symptoms. So you do also have to ask yourself, can they shed the virus and therefore spread it and be asymptomatic and not show signs of being sick? So there are still things we need to learn about, but going into a panic mode and running and getting the toilet paper and, you know, the numbers are going to go up as they get better test kits. You're going to find more people that are tested. And that's not always a bad thing. It means that we are actively surveying, which is what the biodefense strategy, you know, that's part of it, is doing that surveillance.
It's human nature to want to stop and try to find a blame for something like this. Problem is there's nobody or nothing to blame for this situation. So it's natural to want to look at the response and poke holes in it and things like that. I agree with Mary. I mean, the federal agencies are doing everything they can and executing all their authorities to try to tackle this issue. And there's been a number of things that have been done over the years to try to improve that. I know, for example, trying to speed up in an emergency case like this, getting rid of the regulations so you can speed up clinical trials to get medicines on the shelf or get vaccines developed. I mean, remember, this part of the reason this is called novel is because it's new. You know, it hasn't been detected before. So there's a reason we don't have medicines and vaccines ready to go. It's not a failure in preparedness. It's because it's a new naturally created disease. So the key is we get rid of the red tape so we can, you know, respond to this as quickly as possible. And I ensure that, you know, I'm sure that agencies are doing everything they can to try to do that.
You're right. So I think, like, when you're talking about the preparedness, well, like Chris was talking about, I think this always gives us a new chance to say, well, how can we prepare better next time? We can ask ourselves, how do we build more agility, more coordination in the system? We need to rethink that in a 21st century context with convergent technologies and AI, computing, machine learning, plus newer ways and by leveraging the biotech enterprise that we have. Both public and private sector. So I think the opportunity here is how we can use lessons learned from this and apply it in a prospective way. I think we should obviously understand the tremendous value of the basic research enterprise of the country and how we might not convert that research into that development pathway toward solutions so that when we hit the next novel coronavirus, we'll identify it quicker, we'll be able to build a response quicker, we'll be able to handle or perhaps think about in terms of quarantine or get the data quicker. And just have an overall risk-managed response.
I mean, that brings up a good point. And Mary, I'll ask you, what sort of critical steps should we be keeping an eye on the government will be taking?
This is an event that's happening now. And while it's scary and it is a public health emergency declared by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, there will be other events. There will be hurricanes. There will be another biological event down the road. And it's important that we don't take funding from preparing for those events for this one. And we did see that happen in Zika, and they took money before the supplemental appropriations were put out. I think it was 2016. HHS took money from the state and local preparedness to be able to address Zika, and that can be really detrimental.
Final question, what's the bottom line?
What, again, makes it so hard is that there's a number of folks that will get infected that don't know that they're infected, and they'll carry it around. There's higher risk population, older adults, typically 60 and older, especially when you get up into 80 and older, it's the undesirable outcomes go much higher on that. And or if you have what are called comorbidities, meaning you have you're diabetic or you have COPD or other lung type diseases or you've been a smoker in the distant past, those are the things that put you in this place. But I think we're all in this together. I know we have a world-class public health system. The challenge is going to be having it inundated with so many people going into hospitals that it can't treat everybody. And then again, that's why the diagnostics and the science and the vaccine development is so important. We are all looking and hoping very much for that rapid vaccine development, running through the trials of de-risking, being able to manufacture quickly, and starting to implement to get us through this.
So it sounds like the government has learned lessons from past outbreaks. They have a plan. And you can help yourself and others out by doing things like washing your hands frequently or staying at home if you feel sick. Thank you to Mary Dennegan McCauley, Chris Curry, and Tim Persons for taking the time to talk about their work in this area. You can find GAO reports and congressional testimony on pandemic preparedness, the National Biodefense Strategy, and coronavirus at gao.gov. And thank you for listening to this Watchdog Report Deep Dig Edition. To hear more podcasts, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. Make sure you leave a rating and review to let others know about the work we're doing. And for all things GAO, visit us at gao.gov.